Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Frances Moore LaPaye. LaPaye is the author of 18 books, including her 1971 groundbreaking book, Diet for a Small Planet. It was considered a blueprint for eating with a small carbon footprint long before the term was coined. She is co-founder of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and the Small Planet Institute, a collaborative network for research and popular education seeking to bring democracy to life. Her most recent book is Eco Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. It was published last fall by Nation Books. I'm speaking to Frances Moore LaPaye by phone from her offices in New York City. Frances Moore LaPaye, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, your new book, EcoMind, is a roadmap out of what you suggest is a psychic dislocation you believe many people are suffering from. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, it's mainly, I hope, a roadmap out of feeling of powerlessness. I argue that the real problems facing us, be it, you know, climate disruption and global poverty and hunger, that, yeah, these on the one hand are the problem, but the deeper problem is our feeling of powerlessness, because actually solutions are known. So the real challenge is what's stopping us from manifesting the solutions that are already known. And that's what this book is about, that we create the world according to the ideas that we hold. And unfortunately, we're trapped right now in some pretty disempowering ideas.
Yeah. And you also talk about these food thought traps that keep us from real change, like no growth is the answer and consumer society is the problem and humans have lost their connection with nature. Now, you say we need to reframe these negatives. So talk to us about that.
Well, yeah, this is the format of the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it's based in the core insight that I had actually when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, that if you start with the premise of lack, of scarcity, and I claim that the dominant mental map that's going global is this idea that there's not enough of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start from that premise, and not enough of anything, meaning not enough goods and not enough goodness, not enough energy or food and not enough goodness in human beings, then you end up turning over your power. You feel that you can't trust human beings. You know, you have to turn over your fate to some automatic force like the market,
mm-hmm.
which ends up concentrating wealth and actually ends up creating the experience of scarcity no matter how much we produce. So that's a shorthand way of getting at this fundamental challenge of the dominant, what I call the scarcity mind. And the opposite of that is not, you know, oh, abundance, abundance. The opposite of that is the premise of possibility that lies within an eco mind. And so the challenge is to break free from this quantitative, mechanical worldview that pits us against each other and against nature, and move into an eco-mind in which we see possibility, because from an ecological perspective, change is the only constant and everything is so connected that we're all implicated in everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it opens up all sorts of possibility for empowerment. And so I break it down into, yes, you're right, you know, I break it down into pieces, and it's not just a theoretical track. It's really full of stories of possibility where people are shifting away from these limiting ideas.
Mm-hmm. I love the way you quote Anise Nin, too. You said that you quote her, she says, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Now, how do we break people away from that whole notion?
Well, I think that we are in that moment. I think you began this interview, say, this moment of dissonance, when the psychic dislocation, and the dislocation is that all the beliefs that we, at least in my generation, you know, of the 60s generation, I guess we're called, you know, that things could get better, that, you know, that we were headed the right way, and now so much feels like it's going backward. And so I think that people maybe are more open to saying, wait a minute, maybe some of my assumptions aren't working. And I laugh when I think of that. I laugh and cry at the same time of, you know, Alan Greenspan, when he had to admit that this idea that people would behave responsibly in the financial markets left to their own devices, that without rules, that he had to do some profound rethinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's true of all of us, progressives, every one of us. And so I start with the premise that when things really don't match what we expect, then that's the moment that maybe we can look at some of our core assumptions. And certainly one of them that is a thread throughout the book is the idea that if we, you know, if we progressives, if we scare people enough about how terrible things are, that will motivate positive change. And I say that actually what motivates people is a sense of empower, exhilaration and feeling they can be part of the solutions. And if we just focus on the scary dangers and that people actually respond in ways of becoming more materialistic or more self-seeking, so we can defeat our own ends. And so the challenge of this book is how do we articulate the challenge of the environment, of poverty, in a way in which we can see a place for ourselves, because we're going so deep to the roots that we can see how our individual actions actually contribute to change, and then focus on that and let go of the kind of scaremongering.
Mm-hmm. I know. It seems like such a simple idea that fear drives people in the opposite direction than where we want them to go. It seems so logical to me. Now, when talking about consumer society, you suggest that many have forgotten what matters in regard to living fulfilling lives. Tell us your story about that trip you took when you discovered what real luxury is. I love that.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I had this very special opportunity to travel with my extended family from age six to 76 at the time, and we ended up on the Tambopato River in Peru in wandering up the trail to, and I get chills when I think about it, through this jungle trail, and then there was this, in front of my eyes was this mainly bamboo, but, you know, just a wood structure off the ground, open to the jungle sounds, and as we entered and as we enjoyed it and stayed there, and I describe how, you know, suddenly the mosquito netting looked like some elegant queen's draped, you know, uh-huh. bed, and the sounds from the jungle, because there were actually no glass or anything, it was just the walls of my bedroom came up to my hip, and the rest was just the sounds of the jungle, and the lanterns that marked our way, you know, from the main meeting area to our bedrooms. It looked like the most beautiful passageway I'd ever seen. And I was just thinking, oh, my gosh, there are no chandeliers, no, you know, posh anything, you know, no, you know, soft carpets or anything. And this is the most luxurious hotel I've ever been in. And it got me thinking about what is luxury? What is luxury? When I feel that I'm in beauty, that's when I really feel like that is luxury. And so I really took that to heart and started thinking about what would that really mean in our daily lives if we attended to the beauty around us as opposed to the things themselves, but just how do we create beauty through color, through simple placement of objects, through, you know, just simple lines so that we can see the beautiful things, even bringing in a simple plant from the outdoors or, you know, your favorite color on the wall, you know. So that was, it was sort of a gelling, I guess, of a certain insight that, of course, I hope I'd had before, but certainly came home to me then.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a lot of guests in the last few years about the disconnection that people are feeling, even though we're so connected by high tech. And we have lost our way to know what a fulfilling life is, you know? I mean, we used to spend time with friends and family and play games and have nice meals, and people are just not doing that anymore. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I do think people have lost touch because they do feel like buying things is going to fulfill them, but it happened, you know, it's an addiction that only lasts for a moment.
Yeah, yeah. One of my phrases that I'm kind of proud of because of the alliteration in it, in the book, is what we really want is not common purchases, but common purposes. And it's the common sense of purpose that is missing. And so we try to fill it in with the common purchases. But I feel now, potentially, at this moment in my life, I feel that there is an awakening in this country. People are, for example, talking about inequality and talking about private control of our, what I call our privately held government, in a way that hasn't happened, at least since the 60s in my lifetime.
And you're talking about Occupy Wall Street and some of the dialogue around the presidential candidates and stuff, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And so across the political spectra, people are talking about more, you know, what is democracy and what is the role of private wealth and corporations in democracy. And so I have a sense that if we play this right, so to speak, in the deepest sense of play, you know, if we really think about how to keep this awakening moving and not just be another protest movement, but be a proactive movement for what I love to call living democracy. Mm-hmm. Democracy is a culture, not just markets plus voting. That is mm-hmm. not a democracy. We look around the world and we see plenty of countries that have elections and have a market, and yet people live in misery. So I see the possibility that we can claim this moment to put forth a positive vision of what we're working toward, that in which, of course, getting money out of its central role in our political system is foundational, but that is only a piece of it. And mm-hmm. so I, on my better days, I definitely feel like this is a moment I've been waiting for. You know, my book came out just when Occupy started, so it seemed propitious.
Oh, it's been a great up for so many of us. And you know what? You asked this fundamental question that I've thought about a lot too, and the question was, why are we creating a world together that none of us would individually choose? And I think that's a really profound question that we can move from.
Uh-huh.
And so why are we? Do you understand that aspect of it?
Well, my hypothesis, and I'd love to engage with listeners who would engage with me on this, because this is the question that has propelled my life now for several decades.
Mm-hmm.
And my working hypothesis that I present in EcoMind is that because we do create the world according to the ideas we hold, that we together are creating a world that we as individuals would never choose, in fact, violates us, because of the ideas that the assumptions, the unspoken, often unexamined assumptions that we make that are actually perversely aligned with our own nature and with the broader rules of nature. So we end up inevitably then leading to our own disempowerment and creating the very conditions. And I name my hypothesis is that the conditions that bring out the worst in humanity are extreme concentration of power, secrecy in human relationships, and the blaming culture where we're always saying, oh, it's the other guy, instead of saying, hey, wait a minute, we're creating this together. And even if, you know, take the Wall Street debacle, we can't just blame the people who were passing off these investments as viable when they knew that, and some of them were even betting against them, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We can't just blame them because we went along with the deregulation, with the withdrawal of public oversight that allowed that to happen. So, short answer, I believe that we're creating the world that none of us as individuals would choose because we've fallen and absorbed, I should say, some ideas about ourselves and nature that end up creating the very conditions that bring out the worst in us.
Mm-hmm.
The worst in us, because my favorite chapter in EcoMind is the human nature chapter.
Yeah, I love that one too. Absolutely.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. I got to talk about my granddaughter in part, but that chapter, the thought trap is that basically human beings are so selfish and materialistic, you know, that we have to change human nature if we're going to save the planet. And that's a pretty disempowering premise, since changing human nature seems pretty daunting to me. So I argue that actually, no, you know, we evolved, and Adam Smith said it so beautifully, you know, we are social creatures, and so we evolve with just the attributes, just the qualities we need to live in society and to create viable society. So, you know, we have these deep needs and capacity for cooperation, for empathy, for a sense of fairness, and for agency, for power, all of these great things. But our culture is telling us, oh, no, we are just these selfish little shoppers. We are just out to get, you know, out to look out for number one. And so then we distrust ourselves, and that distrust is foundational to the crisis we're in, because if we can't trust ourselves and our neighbors, then we can't believe in democracy. If we can't believe in democracy, then we will allow the kind of anti-democratic forces in terms of the concentration of wealth and power that we have today. So we have to go that deep and challenge some of these very core beliefs about ourselves if we're going to make the turn.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frances Moore LaPay. We're talking about her new book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Now, let's talk about some of the examples that have been happening in our culture that are very positive, which you would probably call a living democracy. More farmers markets, more community gardens, more co-ops, and we see it even happening here in Ithaca. So talk to us about that.
Absolutely. I love in the beginning of the book, you know, I list the things that make me believe that we can do this, and certainly one of them is that although we focus on the power of global corporations, as we should in many ways, that actually it's not all locked up, and I point out that probably more people are members of co-ops in the world than own shares in publicly traded companies, and that several of the most prosperous areas in the world, like in Emilia-Romagna in northern Italy, are prosperous because of the concentration of cooperatives there, and that cooperatives actually offer more employment in the world than do multinational corporations. So there is a whole other way of seeing what works in economic life than simply saying, oh, we have to turn over our fate to a tiny minority, that there are democratic forms of economic organization. And so that certainly is part of it. And then on the environmental front, one of the things that I do throughout the book is highlight examples of this small-d democracy, this actual, you know, the dispersion of power, mutual accountability, the hallmarks of a living democracy rather than the rigged democracy we have now. And, the small-d democracy, I mean the community level, like cooperatives, but also in India, for example, I was so moved to learn about forest management being devolved to communities, to villages, so that regular citizens are involved in protecting their own piece of the forest. And there are now 10 million households in India, in Indian villages, who are protecting the forest and enforcing the rules, creating and enforcing the rules themselves. And as a result, India is one of the few countries where forests are getting healthier instead of worse. So they're sprinkled throughout the book, but this idea that we can do democracy, it's not just something done to us, is foundational.
And a lot of people are under the impression that democracy does have to do with economics and whether you have enough money so that you can grow something. I mean, even here in Ithaca, we almost lost our local bookstore. All the community got together and chipped in money, and it's turned into a co-op, and it seems to be thriving. Really, it's amazing to all of us. But it is. It's people taking back their communities just one little tiny neighborhood at a time.
Yes. And at the beginning of the book, I I'm sure that Ithaca is part of this, is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And you can go to that website at Bali. Just Google Business Alliance Living Economies, I think, is their web address. And this is a network of more than 80 cities in U.S. and Canada that are doing exactly what Ithaca, what you're just describing there, where people are saying, yes, I love my hometown, and I'm going to commit to purchasing things from local proprietors here to support that. And it's really taking off. So this is part of the solution that allows us to see what power we have.
That's right. That's right. And I think social media has a lot to do with that. I mean, there are a lot of negatives about social media. But you know, during Christmas, all these people were saying, shop local, and, you know, writing on Facebook. And it was really amazing empowerment.
Yeah, I noticed that the other day. I don't know what I was looking for, but I can't remember, but I went online and then it said buy local, and oh yeah, it was some energy thing, some health drink I wanted, and said buy local, and I found it was two blocks away. I could just go buy it.
So. That's great. You know, another thought trap that, and this I've talked with many guests about this, is that humans have lost their connection to nature and feel a disconnect from the environment, and so they don't really care about some of the perils we've created. So talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, you even say in your book that 6% of American children ages 9 to 13 play outside unsupervised. Only 6%.
Yeah.
So talk to us about that.
Well, that chapter also really lifted my spirits, writing that chapter. Well, all the chapters did, really. But what I drew together in that chapter is research, a wide variety of sources showing how deeply wired, so to speak, we are. I call it soft-wired to love nature, that astonishing that even a photo, you know, a picture of nature in a hospital room, the sounds of nature in a hospital room will significantly improve the outcome for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And on, you know, that in Netherlands, for example, there are 1,000 farms that are part of the social services network in the Netherlands, so that people suffering from addiction problems or other psychological problems, they have the opportunity to go to a farm and work as part of their, you know, rehab. And the farmers love it because farming is kind of a lonely job,
mm-hmm.
and it's working, and it's greatly, greatly reducing, you know, the recidivism rate, in effect, you know, the relapse rate, I should say. So that sort of thing, how nature is such a beautiful way that we have always used to heal ourselves emotionally. I talk there also about, you know, just the kind of numbers that farmers markets are. The last count was over 7,000. And increased 17% last year, and that's another feeling of direct connection and the community supported agriculture movement. I'm sure Ithaca is big in that as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I tell the story about my step grandson who last Halloween, he'd been going with us now for several summers to pick up our CSA share on the farm, and so Halloween he decided he wanted to be a farmer. For Halloween.
That's great.
And the only farmer he'd met to that point was a woman.
Ah.
So I thought that was even more significant, right? That it was like he was just taken with the farm. And yeah, there's just so many measures of that kind of opening of people, regardless of whether they've had any background before that. I mean, I know, what was the number I just saw of, there was this news program for the government has put in place to enable young people to go into communities and help schools with connecting with local food and that sort of thing. And so many young people applied for the positions that it was much harder to get than a place at Harvard. You know, it was,
wow.
Yeah, it was very encouraging.
Yeah, that's encouraging, too, that you see more and more schools supervising and beginning little gardens for the children to learn where food comes from.
Absolutely.
Which is a simple idea, but it took us a long time to get to that place, too.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I want to talk to you, too, about the final chapter in your book. You talk about civil courage. To talk to us about that.
Well, that idea is simply this, which is foundational to the theme of the book, is that we are good enough, we human beings. That's my case. That, you know, as I said earlier, that we have these beautiful pro-social qualities that, you know, you see in virtually every little kid, right, before culture does much to them. And so we have a lot in us to count on. But what is difficult for us is that we are so social. This is the, you know, the double edge. We are so social that it's very hard to separate from the group, from the tribe, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fear of separation is perhaps the greatest thing that we have to work with right now, because the hyper tribe, as I like to put it metaphorically, of course, that the hyper tribe, meaning the global culture, heading over Victoria Falls, so to speak, we're in this canoe, I can see us, you know, reaching the edge. So separating from the tribe in a moment like this, the early 21st century, has a very different meaning than it did during those eons of evolution when we knew that separating from the tribe meant death.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, separating from the tribe may mean exactly what's needed to support life.
Yeah, you need to take a stand, right? Even if you're afraid of not looking like you belong.
Exactly. So actually, you know, how we relate to fear may be the biggest, you know, the determiner of whether we thrive or not. And so we've got to rethink fear as not telling us, oh, we're in the wrong place, you know, we're in trouble, stop, fight, freeze, or flee.
Uh-huh.
We have to see fear as energy. Fear may be just a signal, not a verdict, just a signal saying, yeah, this is my opportunity to really make a difference. And so we've got to live with the butterflies in our stomach or whatever it takes to stand up in that meeting and say, no, I think we should do this, or to write that letter, to take a stand, to talk to your family about your ideas, even if it's uncomfortable. So that, sometimes it's very mundane, but it's what I call civil courage. And it is the shift in understanding the role of fear. And understanding our social nature, how connected we are to one another, then that also gives us a clue of how to build that courage in us, because it means that we know that we're constantly being shaped by everyone in our environment. And so if we want to become more courageous, we seek out those who are more courageous than we. And in my life, my lodestar of courage for more than a decade now has been Wangari Maathai.
Oh, yes.
Who we lost in September.
Yes, she started the Green Movement.
Mm-hmm, uh-huh. And so she embodies, and now that she's gone, I feel even more that I've got to, in my own way. I mean, you know, I grew up in Texas in the 50s where, you know, women were not particularly encouraged to be leaders or, you know, to be courageous. And so I'm a pretty timid person, actually, and I'm really, really working on myself. And Wangari's example and her courage is a daily, daily reinforcement.
Yeah, and we see that all over the Middle East, too, with some of the uprisings and people standing up against all this power coming at them. It's been a remarkable
yes.
time.
Yes, and study anyone who you admire in that way, because we now know that our brains are wired so that as we observe others, they're part of our brain, the mirror neurons, that are actually firing as if we were doing the act that we are observing. And so this is a powerful way to become more courageous ourselves.
Frances, when we only have a couple of minutes left, I wanted you to talk just a tiny bit about the Small Planet Institute.
Oh, well, I have the great pleasure of working with my daughter specifically. She and I founded the Small Planet Institute after our lives were changed a decade ago as we traveled the world together, and that's where we met Wangari Maathai.
Ah.
Many, many other people, courageous people. So we started an institute which is really working at exactly at this level of changing the ideas that are blocking us. And so she's written two books after that, one called Grub and one called Diet for a Hot Planet. She's working on a video project right now on the food system and the ideas that block us from creating the food system that our bodies and our world needs. So,
and her name is Anne LaPay, right?
Sorry, yes, Anna LaPay.
Anna LaPay, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so we co-founded the Small Planet Institute, which is really a popular education. We work with a lot of different organizations. We've produced 7 books between us and many videos, working with my son, who's a filmmaker. And we've also produced an untold number of articles and blogs and on and on. But it's a great, great pleasure.
And can you give us some contact information in case people want to get in touch with you?
It's very easy. Smallplanet.org. Smallplanet.org. And you can see all the kinds of things that we're up to. And easy to reach us there. It's just info@smallplanet.org. And I would love any feedback on this interview, on the book itself, EcoMind, on any aspect of our work.
Okay. Well, Frances Merlapay, it has been a great pleasure. Keep up the good work. You are a total inspiration. Again, the book is called EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Frances Merlapay, thank you so much.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.